It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, remixing. Everybody get up. Have you ever heard a new song on the radio and thought, wait, I've heard that before? It's kind of like musical deja vu. And take this song, Blurred Lines, by Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams. It was a big hit back in 2013, so it was kind of hard to miss, especially if, like me, you have teenagers at home. Anyway, when I first heard this song, I could have sworn I'd heard it before, but I couldn't quite place it. And then this year, the family of Marvin Gaye won a $7.3 million court case, all because Blurred Lines sounds eerily similar to this. Marvin Gaye's 1977 classic, Got to Give It Up. Let's be honest, this is not an entirely new story. Artists have always borrowed and built off the ideas of others, and even the creators of Blurred Lines admit their song was inspired by Gaye. So what makes this copyright case really interesting is that it falls into the murky space between inspiration and outright imitation. There aren't obvious hooks or melodies that were lifted from Gaye's classic. The percussion and the singing are similar, but does that really count as copying? Where do you draw the line?
There's a long history of sample-related cases going back decades. And that had really been the way that most people understood issues of copyright infringement in music. And so this is something really very different, and that's the main reason why it's so troubling.
Cal Rustiala is a law professor at UCLA. He believes the Blurred Lines decision could have serious negative consequences for musical artists and also for listeners.
There's a couple of things that are problematic. I mean, one is precisely this issue of sounds like. If you think about it, once you open the door to viewing songs as sounding similar to other songs and that being legally actionable, it just opens up an enormous variety of potential lawsuits. And so I think many people who look at music and copyright, both from the music side and from the legal side, are really troubled by the decision in this case. There's just so many songs that draw upon a style or a feeling that somebody else had. And in many cases, that song that's supposedly being copied is itself in many ways drawing upon yet earlier music. And this is the way a lot of creativity works. It builds on prior work and tweaks it and arguably improves it or at least makes it different.
Well, and it's so subjective, right? I mean, sounds like. What is that based on exactly?
It's very subjective. It's very subjective. And that's why in the previous cases that really dealt with sampling, it was a little bit simpler because you can say, okay, these, as in one case, these three notes were copied. A string of notes together can be identified. And it's really not that subjective. The feeling or the sounds like test is totally different. And, you know, I would draw kind of a parallel to something like Starbucks and coffee bean and tea leaf. So if the notion is, well, someone came along and took Starbucks coffee shop and kicked it up a notch and made it a little bit different, and then somebody else came along and so on and so forth. In these kind of situations, sure, these coffee shops seem similar. But I think we would have a lot of trouble saying that whoever was first ought to be able to sue whoever was second. I think we think that kind of competition is good and that that's kind of how markets work. You know, people have a good idea and somebody takes it and tweaks it.
Well, this gets tricky, surely, because we're talking about – I mean, somebody could argue that you're trying to compare apples and oranges. Maybe a commercial product like a Starbucks, maybe that's pretty different and should be pretty different from a creative product like a piece of music or a novel.
Well, I would differ on that on a number of grounds. One, I think certainly culinary arts are arts in the same way that musical arts are arts. But if you want to sort of steer away from those kind of parallels and just think about novels, one of the things we do in copyright traditionally is we understand that there's a concept of genre and we have something called the censo-faire doctrine, which basically says there are certain stock things that are understood to go with a certain type of story. Something like a story involving wizards might have pointy hats and beards. Mm-hmm. So when J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, she was not sued by the J.R.R. Tolkien estate, the writer of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, And I think rightly so, because although there, too, there were wizards with hats and beards, it's understood that that's part of what makes a wizard a wizard.
Right. But in that case, Tolkien didn't invent wizards and beards. But if J.K. Rowling had named her world Middle-earth, that might have been copyright infringement.
That might have been. So it really is a question of what's at stake. So likewise, in this case, did Marvin Gaye invent funk music? No. He's a fantastic or was a fantastic artist. But he himself riffed openly on the work of others who preceded him and acknowledged that.
Yeah. There's this long history of artists who build on the style of their predecessors. I mean, you could argue that pretty much this is the way the arts, the creative arts, works. You know, Rolling Stones borrows from Muddy Waters. Picasso borrows from Cézanne. But I think one reason that so many people were really upset about this ruling is that it seems to ignore the way artistic creativity works and even to redefine and set a kind of chillingly high bar for originality.
I couldn't agree more. I think that we often have a kind of popular understanding of creativity or innovation, even in, say, technology, that really privileges the idea of kind of a eureka moment or a pioneering invention or creative work. And that certainly does happen sometimes. But much more common is work that takes something that already exists and makes it better or makes it different, tweaks it, builds on it, improves it. And we understand that when we talk about ideas like genre or trends, those are things that look alike. That's a series of things that look alike in some way or another. So, you know, you could pick any number of art forms and see that. And so I think that's really at the heart of creative work. And people really are influenced by others and sometimes overtly make that clear. And there's plenty of examples in contemporary music and older music of that. And we've never thought of that as being something that broke the law. We thought of it as, you know, maybe not so original, maybe a little bit derivative. Depends, obviously. It's something that's in the ear of the beholder, but never something that violated the law until this case.
You know, listening to you, it's hard not to think that the entire legal profession is kind of at fault here and that we've carried copyright law to extremes and really have kind of privatized and monetized what should never have been monetized in the first place.
Well, I think there's something to that. I do think that copyright has been taken too far. So in my book with Chris Sprigman, The Knockoff Economy, we kind of explore that concept in a lot of different domains. And I think one of the things that's so interesting about looking at the creative world is that there are many creative arts that are not protected by copyright that are extremely creative nonetheless. And so that calls into question whether we really need this hammer of copyright to foster creativity, which is the ostensible purpose of copyright, to make it possible for people to create in the first place.
Well, it's also interesting what creative products we copyright and what we consider not copyrightable. There's a story you tell about a couple of New York chefs, but maybe you should tell the story of Ed's Lobster Bar.
Sure. So in New York, there's a well-known restaurant called the Pearl Oyster Bar. And at one point, a chef from Pearl, a chef named Ed, went off and opened his own restaurant just maybe a mile away called Ed's Lobster Bar. And there was a kind of legal action taken. In the end, it was settled. There was a legal action taken by the owner of Pearl Oyster Bar arguing that Ed had taken, essentially copied the look and feel of the restaurant and even copied their iconic and original Caesar salad. So what makes this story so interesting is it gets at this same set of questions we're talking about with regard to music. What's the line between, you know, reasonable homage or derivative works versus something that's against the law? And in the case of cuisine, you can't copyright a recipe. I'll say in my own opinion, Ed's Lobster Bar looked a lot like Pearl Oyster Bar. And I'll also say Pearl Oyster Bar is a better restaurant. But the fact is there was nothing particularly original about Ed's or Pearl's. They all were, in a sense, copies of something further back, which is the traditional New England seafood shack. Mm. And so I think it nicely illustrates the fact that what we do when we create is typically stand on someone else's shoulders and build something slightly better. And that's at the heart of the creative endeavor. That's something to be applauded. It's not something to be sued over.
But on the other hand, I mean, you said you can't copyright a recipe, which maybe is sort of a shame. I mean, for instance, somebody somewhere invented that molten chocolate cake that's everywhere now. So right. soon, you know, every upscale restaurant in the country now does a version of molten chocolate cake. Well, whoever invented it is getting no credit and, more importantly, no money. Isn't that a problem?
I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. We talk about this a bit in the book as well. There's some dispute over who really invented the molten chocolate cake, and it might have been any number of people who just took a cake out too soon and discovered it wasn't fully cooked. But you're right that it's spread. In fact, it's in Chili's now. It's not just upscale restaurants. It's everywhere. But I don't think that it's an example of what's wrong with the system. I think it shows that people can continue to create even when their creative works are copied. And the reason is that there's lots of value that comes from being an originator that does not require you to have a monopoly over that creation. So, you know, in the case of cuisine, it's something you really eat in a particular place. And so experiencing the molten chocolate cake in one restaurant versus another is going to be very different. And of course, the cakes are going to vary and people are going to kind of twist and tweak the recipe a little bit here and there. And I think it also proves that chefs continue to be very creative even in the face of this kind of copying. Every good chef knows that his or her work can be reverse engineered by another chef. That's the way restaurants work, and they understand that. But they continue to create nonetheless, and I think that illustrates a point I made earlier. We don't always need copyright law to get people to create. They'll create anyway. And that's what we want in our society, is a creative society that's full of innovation.
So what you're saying is that copying actually drives innovation. To argue the other side, I guess, if we live in a culture that's filled with imitations and remixing, you're suggesting that that's really good for innovation. You could also argue that maybe that's a culture that's a little low on creativity. I mean, right now, you know, you must feel like every time I turn on the radio or listen to music, I hear songs that sound just like all the other songs.
I don't disagree that there are some downsides to this. And I want to be clear on this point. I'm not opposed to having protection for creative works. Mm-hmm. So I believe in copyright and trademark and patent. I think they're very important. I think the question is, what's the right balance? We don't want a society in which everything is just a kind of ripoff of something else. But at the same token, if you don't have some scope for building on what's come before you, that itself can be impoverishing. So it's a question of balance.
Cal Rustiala teaches law at UCLA, and he's the co-author of The Knockoff Economy, How Imitation Spurs Innovation. So here's a puzzle for you. If pop culture is all about the next big thing, why does so much of it celebrate the past? Like, why is retro chic a thing? Why do so many movies get remade? And why do so many of today's pop hits sound like they could have been released decades ago? Music critic Simon Reynolds is the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. He thinks we've reached a tipping point in our taste for nostalgia. He talked with Steve Paulson.
A lot of cultures and societies feel like the past was the golden age and we're fallen in some way. So that aspect is not new. What is new, I think, is this sort of fixation on the immediate past, you know, the sort of way the material is available to us in terms of film footage, videos, images of the stars and the clothes they wore, and also just the recordings, you know, and that means that retro is a lot more exact in its copying of the past.
So there's actually a certain faithfulness to copying it. It's not just sort of, I don't know, blandly drawing on certain influences from, let's say, the 1980s. It's actually, you know, really knowing what was going on there and kind of making an exact copy of it in certain ways.
Yeah, I mean, the people, you know, if you look at an artist like LaRue, she's gone to some trouble to get that 80s synth sound, you know, and actually have the limitations of the music at that time. So you could get a much less rigid sort of rhythm these days with modern technology. But she's gone for that certain kind of stiff electronic sound, you know, those simple sequenced electronic patterns. Obviously, she loves that period of music. people can do it more creative than other people, and people kind of shuffle fragments from different eras and different sort of stylistic traits and things together to make interesting results. One thing that I do in the book is I actually look at rock's own history of revivalism and looking back. It did start quite early. The first major wave of it was in the early 70s when you had the 50s rock and roll nostalgia wave. And that was in music with Shanana, and John Lennon did some very basic stripped down 50s inspired music. But you also had it in movies with American Graffiti, you had Happy Days series. It was sort of culture-wide moment of, I guess the 70s was a quite dark and depressing time, and also music had got kind of very sophisticated. So there was a kind of nostalgia for the simplicity and seeming innocence of rock and roll.
Now, what you've done here with your book Retromania is more than just survey what's been going on. You're making an argument here that there's something bad about all of this. I mean, you're saying that, really, this is we're losing originality, or many artists today really don't know how to be original because they keep just mining the past.
Yeah, I mean, I see it a lot with new bands where it's very easy to see their reference points. But also, you know, you read an interview with them, practically the first thing they do is they reel out their reference points. It's almost become like a mode of creativity or recreativity, really, because they're more like curators or editors in the sense that they sift through all this material because it's there and it's super accessible.
Give me some examples of this.
Well, some of these people who do it, you know, I rather enjoy. There's an artist called Destroyer. His new album, Kaput, is actually not typical of all his work, but he's done an album that's very closely inspired by the sort of mid-80s glossy intelligent pop of people like Prefab Sprout and the Blue Nile. There's also a bit of a Roxy Music kind of vibe. Like, he's very deliberately gone for these 80s mid-80s expensively produced signifiers, like his sax solos. Apparently sax solos are coming back in a sort of kind of ironic yet at the same time genuinely enjoyed kind of way as an 80s reference point. The kind of sax solo you would get in a Hall & Oates song or certain Roxy Music songs from that time. It's actually a really enjoyable record. I really enjoy it, but it's interesting that that's how a lot of intelligent young musicians operate, in this sort of way of sifting through the past and piecing together an identity, and even doing it in a specific way for one project.
So are you saying then that today's musicians just don't know how to create new art because they're so obsessed with the past? I mean, with all these musical references, with this keen sense of history, but maybe in the process losing the ability to make something new?
I think that there's a certain sense in which I think people are overpowered by the abundance of all this archival material.
But they don't have to obsess over it. I mean, they could still go off, as artists for eons have done, to create something new.
Well, perhaps it's hard to when you're mentally crowded out by all these images. In the art world, these were issues that a lot of artists faced. For instance, there was this movement called the appropriation art, the pictures generation. And there was an artist called Sherry Levine who did these pictures that were kind of famous pictures that she reproduced, and then she put her signature on them, and they were called After Egon Schiele or After Walker Evans. And she had a manifesto that was all about how the modern artist is flooded with images. They've almost kind of glutted with the wealth of painting from the art from the past. Her art was about that. It was actually addressing this issue of how to find something new to say in a sort of cultural environment where you're just flooded with material, you know.
Mm-hmm. You write about something that I'd never heard of before, hauntology. Can you explain what this is?
I'll try and keep it simple. It gets quite labyrinthine. But, I mean, hauntology is this term that actually Jacques Derrida came up with, and it was specifically to do with the idea that Marx, although communism was considered dead, the ghost of Marx stalks our culture as this kind of reproachful figure. The idea of equality and the sharing of wealth and all these things that an ideal form of Marxism represented, you know, that is still a reproach to the world, even despite the declaration of the end of history and the triumph of liberal capitalism. Hauntology had this resonance outside philosophy and political theory It's been picked up by artists. There's a lot of artists who are using ideas to do with haunting, memory, ruins, you know, all these sort of slightly morbid and bleak-seeming concepts.
You write about a Scottish duo called the Boards of Canada, which you say was the immediate ancestor of the UK hauntologists.
Yes, well, the Boards of Canada is a kind of, the name itself is referring to these educational movies that they used to see as children, the brothers who were behind Boards of Canada. So that has an association with sort of childhood, school, the kind of sense of wonder that you had for nature documentaries and scientific programs showing microbes or whatever. Those kind of associations is what they're playing on. But also the sounds they use are often very deliberately sort of faded and distressed and have a kind of quality that's actually like a sonic equivalent of like old Super 8 childhood movies, you know, where they kind of mottled with colour and are fading a bit or yellowing. You know, I listen to the Boards of Canada and it has this really potent effect on me, partly because some of the sounds they use remind you of the music in these sort of educational movies or children's TV programs of the 70s when I was a kid. Synthesizer sounds that kind of have this, it's a bit like Proust's Madeleine cake, you know, where the character bites into the cake and all these memories flood back. Listening to their music has that effect, the eerie effect of memories coming to my head, images from childhood. And I think this is what a lot of these groups are playing on.
Well, it seems that there is a paradox at the center of everything that you're saying here. On the one hand, you say this is lame and shameful. I mean, sort of this obsession with, you know, mining the past. But you clearly enjoy a lot of this too.
Yeah, it's a conflicted book. I'm always interested in innovation and stuff I've never heard of, you know, that sounds like I've never heard anything like it before. And I'm always looking for that. That sort of future rush is what I call it in the book. But at the same time, I'm a deeply nostalgic person and could happily spend hours on YouTube.
So when you look into your crystal ball, do you think this rerun culture or this retro culture will just keep going on forever, or will it end at some point? And if so, what will bring it to an end?
Well, one thing actually that could bring it to an end, I think to some extent, will be the decline of a thrift store economy. If more and more books and music only exist in digital form, you don't need to throw it away, and you can't throw it away, and you can't sell it on. So at a certain point, there'll be a cut-off point. Thrift stores and flea markets and similar places will only have 20th century pre-digital analog era material. Maybe that stuff will carry on having an interest. But I think also maybe a new breed of people will come along who've never owned culture in a physical form and won't have any interest in cluttering up their lives. They'll want to be mobile. They'll want to have empty apartments. As the cloud develops, people won't even own the stuff inside their computers. It'll be up there somewhere.
Simon Reynolds is the author of Retromania, Pop Culture's Addiction to Its Own Past. Steve Paulson talked with him. Coming up, how has copyright law changed over the past few decades? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about remix culture, artistic nostalgia, and the limits of intellectual property in this hour. And as we've already heard, the distinction between inspiration and copyright infringement can be pretty thin. But has it always been that way? Here's media scholar Siva Vaidyanathan on the evolution of copyright law.
One, two, and go on.
It gave authors exclusive rights to control the copying and commercial exploitation of their work for a period of 14 years, and it was renewable. So it was a very limited right, one that would likely expire during an author's lifetime, and then that work would be pushed toward the public. In other words, the public would then own it in return for granting that temporary monopoly. So this was an essential step in building a national culture. But the beautiful thing about the American bargain was it still allowed for future creators, for the next generation of creators, to use established works in various ways. The culture of copyright changed pretty radically just in the last 20 years. And as a matter of fact, the law changed along with it. Perhaps the changes in the law created or helped create this moment of intense vigilance about protection. But what we've reached now is a point where copyrights last almost forever. For instance, life of the author plus 70 years or 95 years. Those are the established terms of copyright in the United States right now. And more than that, Congress keeps extending the duration of copyrights of stuff that is already out there, works that have been published long ago, and works for which there is no incentive to create right now. And they're doing this only for the benefit of a handful of media companies. Copyright is supposed to be an incentive to create the next generation of works, but we're actually in a moment when copyright is counterproductive. Young emerging artists are having real trouble doing what they want to do without fear of a lawsuit because works that they want to build on are not in the public domain, because lawyers are so vigilant that they are sending cease and desist letters over the most ridiculous claims. As a result, what artists are doing now, and they often call me and tell me this, is they're assuming they're going to get in trouble, and they're telling themselves, you know, maybe I better not. And I think this is a really sad moment in American cultural history when artists are being cowed by the threat of legal action. And I think that we and Congress and the courts have not thoroughly thought out the ways that music and culture should flow through our lives, the sort of cultural regulation that would be ideal to both sustain these industries and the level of creativity and sustain a sense of democratic culture and general freedom. I think that if we're deciding whether to change the law, we should appeal to that first principle, which is, will this encourage new creativity or will it discourage new creativity, with full awareness that all creativity builds on previous creativity. We've let copyright be purely in the domain of experts. We've let the media companies walk into the back halls of Congress and write the legislation, and then our congressmen have simply passed it, assuming that everybody supports the Disney Corporation. Well, things aren't quite so simple anymore, and it's time that the American people start to realize that we're losing important aspects of our culture and our cultural heritage because they're being locked up.
Siva Vaidyanathan teaches at the University of Virginia School of Law and is the author of Copyright and Copy Wrongs: The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. For the most part, we've been talking about remixing from an artist's perspective, about whether it should be illegal for a musician to create a work that's too derivative of another. But there's another kind of remix that goes back decades, though I guess it seems kind of dated now, the mixtape. We're talking back before the days of the digital playlist, when putting together the perfect sequence of songs to give to your sweetheart could take hours or days or maybe even weeks. Jason Bittner has a lot of nostalgia for those days. He's the editor of a book and website called Cassette for My Ex. Up until recently, it shared the stories and the soundtracks to many early romances.
This all started a few months back when I was going through some boxes in my basement, and I realized that I have just 3 tapes left, you know, from my teenage years, and none of them were retail. None of them are store-bought tapes. They were all mixtapes, like ones that people who were interested in me had made for me. And it occurred to me, you know, there's got to be something here. Like, why did these tapes stick with me for the past 16 or 18 years? And it just kind of dawned on me that it's because they're special. You know, they carry a lot of meaning and a lot of weight and a lot of nostalgia. So, you know, going back and putting this into my cassette player, all of these memories started flooding back, you know, listening to these tapes when I first got them, driving around in my car. And it dawned on me that if I have one of these tapes, there's probably a lot of people who've managed to hold on to these tapes for, you know, decades.
Well, tell us about some of the submissions your website has gotten. People have sent you in mixtapes and told you stories about them. You brought a few in, right?
Yeah, we have a few different ones here. I like this one from Dave Nadelberg. He kind of tells us the story about how he'd never received a mixtape to date. You know, he'd always been making them for other people, but he himself had never received one from someone. So he starts off, "We were at a rave in Ithaca, New York. I was drunkish. She was stonedish. Despite our inebriated vision, it was lust at first sightish. This was the start of my relationship with Amy, a short-lived affair that, from that moment on, was defined by music. Not surprisingly, during one of our first sober conversations, Amy and I discussed our mutual love of making mixtapes. A few weeks later, Amy handed me a decorative yellow cassette. It even had a title, Obliteration, the spine read. Obliteration was to be the soundtrack of our relationship."
I take it the relationship didn't go too well.
He goes on, "Truth be told, as much as I appreciated it, the tape seemed thrown together, kind of like two strangers making out on a dance floor." And he goes on to say, "I had to face the music. It wasn't meant to be."
There's one song on that tape, Saturday Night.
Yeah, again, that was an Edgetomic Dustbin song. And that, for me, that sort of captures the energy and the spirit from where Dave had met the woman who made him the mixtape. It's kind of a classic early 90s party jam.
If Dave's mixtape was kind of a failed love letter, tell me a story about a love letter that, or a love mixtape that really works.
Well, there's one in particular. Jamie Hayes was growing up outside of St. Louis, and she received this very sweet cassette. I guess it's best spoken in her words. She says, "My boyfriend delivered it along with breakfast in bed on the morning of my 20th birthday, hence the title, Good Morning, You're 20. In the mix, you can hear the excitement and enthusiasm in the tape of being young, newly in love with each other, and in love with music. While the relationship didn't last, the tape did, staying in heavy rotation all the way until last year when I finally got an iPod."
What music is on her tape?
This one's great. This one has a lot of soul and funk and a little bit of reggae. But there's one song that starts off side A. It's Soul Brothers 6, Some Kind of Wonderful.
"I don't need a whole lot of money. I don't need a big fine car. I got everything that a man wants. I got more than I could ask for.
Picturing a 20-year-old getting that song from her boyfriend on her birthday. It's just, oh, it's kind of like a love letter that you save and reread every few years so you can always remember what it felt like to be loved like that.
Absolutely. There's a lot of nostalgia and a lot of sweetness on this tape. Kind of contrary to the one that we were just listening to from Dave Nadelberg, this one just has like just this real sweetness and enthusiasm. that goes with really just loving one another in a real kind of simple and young kind of a way.
Mm. Of course, when you're young in those years, love can also be filled with anguish and, you know, sorrow. One of my favorite stories on your website is from Fiona Maisel.
Yes, this one has the end of the relationship. Fiona tells us a story about being in a relationship for about a year and then her parents telling her that the situation is changing. She says, "In May of that year, my parents announced that we were moving to Los Angeles. I had a party in our apartment a couple months before, which sent one kid to the hospital with kidney failure, so there was no trusting me to stay behind and finish out high school in New York. Me and John were doomed. I didn't take it well. He took it worse. I was going to California. The first guy who ever loved me was not. He made me a mixtape."
Shall I assume he put "Going to California" on the mixtape?
Side A, first song, Led Zeppelin, "Going to California." It was perfect.
Spend my days with a woman unkind, smoke my stuff and drink all my wine. Made up my mind, make a new start, going to California with an aching in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair.
This one has just a ton of really great loaded songs also. Towards the end of side B, you start getting into some Guns N' Roses' Patience, and then you get to Dire Straits' So Far Away, and the final song on the end of side B, The Doors, The End.
Oh, you kind of get the feeling that Fiona and her boyfriend maybe were sort of relishing that feeling of love and longing and, you know, true love.
I imagine they were. And, you know, it's this mixtape just really encapsulates, like, that moment, you know. This is a tape that was intended to be listened to in the car when she's heading, you know, the 3,000 miles from New York all the way to the West Coast. You could just picture her in her cassette, you know, somewhere outside of Omaha, just sitting with the emotion that's kind of throughout the tape.
Right. Trapped in her car with her horrible parents, with her headphones on, just dreaming of her boyfriend back home.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's funny, although Fiona doesn't really tell us much about the boyfriend. You know, I think we know his name is John, and that's about it. You hear that song, and you really get a picture of this teenage guy who's dreaming of his girl in California. I guess it makes me realize that what an intimate thing making a mixtape can be. This is the end.
It's true, you know, it really, in this case, song selection was spot on, you know, he really nailed it. And it sounds like he really sent the message he was intending, you know. There's a lot of wistfulness, a lot of heartache, and sort of the sense of inevitable doom. You know, cross-country relationships when you're in high school generally don't work out for the best.
I'll never look into your eyes again.
Jason Bittner was the editor of Cassette for My Ex. By the way, as a side note, most of the songs we've been sampling, including this one, were all once accused of being copies. We put together a Spotify playlist with all the songs and their purported originals. You can find it on our website at ttbook.org. That's it for our conversation about remixing. But coming up, Harvard Divinity School historian Karen King tells us how newly discovered early Christian texts are shedding new light on the life and teachings of Jesus. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
Hi, I'm Tony Grafton. I teach European history at Princeton, and I'm here to tell you that Latin can save your life. I didn't always know or believe this, but in the last few years, I found that my students at Princeton were doing work of a quality and a scale that I'd never seen before. And the reason I realized this was I was found I had to get up at 4 a.m. in order just to keep up with what they were doing. And I began to wonder how this was possible. What was igniting these students? What I discovered was that most of them had gone to a summer institute in Rome where they learned to speak Latin. The method was founded by an American priest who used to write Latin documents for the Pope. He was a grumpy, wonderful man who invited anyone who wanted to come study Latin with him in the summer and taught you not how to translate Latin. He hated that. He thought it was stupid that people could take 10 years of Latin and would only be able to translate 30 lines. He would say, every bum and prostitute in the ancient city of Rome could speak Latin, and you're going to do that too, and then you'll really be able to read it. And he would yell at people. He spoke sharply at them. He needled them, and they loved him. And by the end of those summers, they could do it. They could speak Latin. They could hear the music and the poetry. They could hear the scorn and the satires. Well, a number of young scholars have taken this up. They've built a bit of an endowment with scholarships so they can take kids who can't afford it. They bring these students to Rome, and for a month, they march them around. They read Latin books in the places they're about. They read about gladiators in the Colosseum. They have classes where students are constantly challenged, not just to translate, but to make Latin their own, to talk about Latin in Latin. They sing Latin. They rap Latin. It makes them inspired students. It gives them vocations. They want to teach. These students are seeing themselves as chosen to keep Latin alive. And others find inspiration in this to do things like, in one case, building a tutoring program for third graders in Bushwick to get them off the streets, which aren't safe, and have them reading Latin. In an age when the humanities are full of despair, when studies that don't seem to bring any profit are despised, there's something about this which I don't yet understand, but I'm here to say it's the most hopeful thing I've seen in the humanities in about 20 years, and it works. I have seen the future, said Lincoln Steffens when he went to Soviet Russia, and it works. Well, he was wrong, but I have seen the past, and it does work.
Historian Anthony Grafton with his dangerous idea. You'll find more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. And on our minds, Christians around the world are celebrating Easter this week, so we're revisiting an interview with Harvard Divinity School historian Karen King about the life of Jesus. And she's especially interested in the early Christian texts, the ones that didn't make it into the Bible. And she believes they give us a fuller understanding of what it means to be a Christian.
Part of what I do, of course, is look at the broad shape of early Christianity, not just those materials that made it into the canon, but also these new discoveries we have. And for me, what they do is they allow us to hear alternative voices. They allow us to read the Bible fresh, if you will.
When you talk about new discoveries, you're talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls?
When I talk about new discoveries, I'm thinking mostly of Christian texts we've discovered in Egypt over the last century or so, primarily a set of materials discovered at a place in Middle Egypt called Nag Hammadi. There, a peasant found a set of 13 papyrus books hidden in a jar in the desert. And these are really revolutionizing our notions of what Christianity looked like, especially in the 2nd to 4th centuries. These are mostly early Christian texts that show us the path not taken. In a way, the winners get to tell the story their way, you know, and silence other voices. And these texts are giving us, or restoring to us, some of those alternative lost voices.
Do these new texts cover some of the most standard ground of the New Testament? I mean, for instance, take the story of the resurrection. How many different versions of the resurrection are there?
Oh, I'd have to sit and think to count how many different versions of the resurrection. But the new texts do have some new accounts of the resurrection, but mostly they have new interpretations of what the resurrection is about. One of the most astonishing texts is one that Apocalypse of Peter, which suggests that the Jesus who was crucified on the cross is different from the cosmic Christ, the revealer. And it goes on to talk about the way that the body is not the self. Many Christians understood the resurrection of Jesus to be a spiritual resurrection.
I thought that was kind of a very recent way of interpreting the resurrection. I guess I thought that in the days of early Christianity, the resurrection was always understood to be a literal physical event, you know, that Jesus appeared in the flesh 3 days after his crucifixion.
I think this is one of the ways in which when we read the Bible, we already know what it says, so we read it into the texts. But if you look very carefully at what kind of body Jesus has when he rises from the dead, it walks through walls. He appears in locked rooms. The people closest to him in his life don't even recognize who he is. But the earliest accounts we have a very ambiguous body. One has to ask, what kind of body is this? From the very beginning, there were notions that the resurrection was a spiritual resurrection, not one that was a physical bodily resurrection.
Did early Christians all pretty much down the line believe that there was a resurrection?
I think that's pretty universal. And the question is only, what kind is it? With what kind of body will we rise? And even more than that, what does it mean? Why did God want his son to die and to be raised? What is the meaning of that? Those were the things that they were most interested in and debated very, very strongly.
Well, for centuries, one of the chief articles of Christian faith has been the belief that Jesus died to atone for the sins of humanity. Was that how it was always understood among those first early Christians?
You get that idea very early on because, of course, the Greco-Roman world is a world where the practice of sacrifice is very broadly practiced, and this notion of atonement comes in very early. But we can see that not everyone agreed. Not everyone thought that that was the proper way to understand the death of Jesus. And in particular, there were Christians who questioned whether a good and loving God would want his son to suffer such a cruel death.
Well, if they didn't interpret Jesus' death as a form of atonement for humanity's sins, then how did they interpret it? Why did Jesus die then?
One notion is to show that the powers of the world are not in control, that God is in control. Another kind of view is precisely to show that one should concentrate on the spiritual aspects of life and not on the physical. Jesus comes into this world as a revealer, and it's his teachings that bring salvation, not his death and resurrection.
You know, listening to you, I just have a glimpse of what an incredibly knotty, tangled thing it must have been for the early church fathers to codify Christian faith.
Well, it was a long process. One thinks of it happening over a period of 3 or 4 centuries. And, of course, they only really come to a kind of an agreement when Constantine, the Roman emperor, converts, calls the bishops together and tells them to sit down and solve their difficulties. Now, part of it, of course, is only some people got invited. So they were already somewhat on the same page when they arrived, and they simply excommunicated anybody who disagreed.
Some of these things that we take as basic articles of faith, in fact, were very political decisions.
Yes, political in the sense that they were contested, that power relations was at stake, who was in charge, what communities would look like, who would be cast out as heretics, who would get to gain from Constantine, who gave a lot of financial aid in various kinds of ways to the churches. So, yes, politics were involved, even though I think we don't want to reduce it to that.
This raises a fundamental question, don't you think, about how we should read the scriptures, and in particular, whether they can or should be taken literally. I mean, how do you sort out this question?
I think the question you raised about reading the scriptures is an important one, precisely because I think it's very hard to read the scriptures literally. We can look, for example, at the figure of Mary Magdalene. And most people, like myself, were raised with the notion that she was a prostitute. And now we're hearing that she wasn't, that this was something that was invented in the 5th century. We see it first in the sermons of Pope Gregory, for example. But my question is, why is it that nobody noticed that for 1,500 years, that the New Testament, which is our best and most reliable source about Mary Magdalene, doesn't say that she's a prostitute? Why did no one see that? Or, for example, in reading Genesis, I ask students to read it and close their Bibles and tell me what it says. And inevitably, they say Adam and Eve ate an apple, that the serpent was a snake, that the topic is original sin. And then I ask them to open their Bibles again. And sure enough, no apple, no snake is the devil. There's no language of original sin. It's because, you know, the apple comes from Milton and so forth. So people tend to know what the text says ahead of time and read it in. And again, I think this is one of the most important things that these new texts can do, is they can make us go back and look at the text and say, what does it really say about Mary Magdalene?
Why do you think the story of Mary Magdalene is important today? I mean, I know it's very hot, very popular right now, but does she matter?
Mary Magdalene matters for a number of reasons, because she's one of the most prominent women in the biblical story. And insofar as the biblical story shapes so much about how people see the world, what they think is appropriate, and the roles of women in general, then she becomes important. So insofar as she's seen as a prostitute, or we have Mary the Mother, the Virgin, Mary Magdalene, the repentant prostitute, and these are the models of femininity we have. Now with the Da Vinci Code, we have a new model, you know, Mary the wife and mother. But if we look historically, the role that we have the best evidence for is Mary Magdalene as a disciple and as an apostolic leader. And that, of course, makes a lot of difference. Instead of seeing women solely in terms of their sexuality, we can see women as spiritual leaders in their own right. The historical Mary Magdalene lets us have that and have that vision, that role model within Christianity for women's leadership in the church.
And then that raises, I think, an interesting question in terms of how do you then reconcile historical fact and faith? You know, I mean, what does it mean in this case to reclaim Mary Magdalene, to uncover the real historical facts about her? It's interesting historically, but is it interesting from a faith perspective?
I think it has to be. If faith is not based in what is true, then we're really in trouble. The religious life, for me, is best characterized as seeking. And faith is distorted, I think, when it's presented to us as blind obedience and authoritarianism, when one suggests that it's obvious what the Bible says, when it has been contested, and when, in fact, the interpretation of the Bible is precisely a place for the Christian to engage.
And what about for you personally? You're an observant Christian?
Yes, uh-huh.
And how do you connect your scholarly work and your own personal faith, or do those two connect?
Oh, they connect very clearly and very dramatically for me. I mean, the kind of work one does in history and in the study of theology and so forth requires a kind of honesty and courage to face the ambiguities and the contradictions in the tradition, not to settle for easy answers and authority instead of thoughtfulness and instead of evidence.
Karen King is a historian at Harvard Divinity School. Her books include The Secret Revelation of John and What is Gnosticism? To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tungekar produced today's show with help from Sarah Nix, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Craig Ely. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.